Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
We share with other animals the experience of violence, of pain, fear, and loss. But human beings are the only species that reflects on those experiences and names their sources evil. From earliest times to yesterday's news, humankind has always been concerned, some might even say obsessed, with evil. Nevertheless, so far we've failed to understand evil fully. Scholars and philosophers, theologians and psychologists, and thinkers of all persuasions continue to struggle with the existence of evil. Today, we'll be talking about the contemporary stage in that struggle. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host on the New Books Network with the Van Leer Jerusalem Institute. Today, we'll be talking with Professor Jerome Gelman about his book, The History of Evil, From the Mid-20th Century to Today. Jerome Yehuda Gelman is Emeritus Professor of Philosophy at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev, an honorary professor at Australian Catholic University. He has published widely in Analytic Philosophy of Religion and in the Constructive Jewish Theology. Yehuda Gelman, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Why study evil?
Well, this book, which I edited, is the sixth in a series of books on the history of evil, and it represents what thinkers and philosophers have said about evil, because evil is so much part of our lives. It's not something that intrudes on an otherwise jolly life, but it's built into the very nature of the world and the nature of our existence. And we are called upon to face evil almost on a daily basis, sometimes great and horrendous evils. And it is part of the human nature to have to deal with evil, theorizing on evil, and get it going ahead.
Some people say that human evil is built into nature. In the plant and animal worlds, everyone is somebody else's potential lunch. Evil, therefore, is merely a byproduct of evolution. And such ideas as survival of the fittest, the will to power, and the like can explain all human evils, tribalism, war, slavery, cruelty. Tell us what supports that point of view and what's unsatisfying about it.
There, in philosophical discussions of evil, there are two categories. One is called moral evil, which is close to what you are explaining now or describing now. And that is evils that are perpetrated by one person or one group to another person or to another group. There are also what philosophers call natural evils, which pertains to hurricanes, tsunamis, and earthquakes, and the like. Now, it is a fact that we are, as far as moral evil, the one that you've been raising about interpersonal evils, that humanity, as well as other animals, has a great desire for self-preservation, which becomes a desire for all concomitant and related things which can aid our self-preservation and our reproduction. Now, this is an explanation insofar as we are talking about evolutionary theory or even without evolutionary theory. This is a fact about humanity. And that has to do with the fact that we are so much in danger, you might say, or having to solidify our positions in the world. From a naturalistic point of view, this is all a matter of evolution. From some religious points of view, and I personally bear a religious understanding of evil to some extent or other, it is only God who is totally giving and has no self-interest. And what God has created is a world in which we have self-interest and are dominated in self-interest. But we don't stop there. The purpose of our existence is to overcome, to whatever degree is possible, this egocentric stance in the world, and to become godlike, that is, to transform ourselves into creatures that are giving and loving in place of our own selfishness and egocentric positions. That's how I see it.
The time period covered in this volume includes the largest and most systematic and horrifying evil the planet has ever seen, the Holocaust. In what way does massive evil present a different philosophical or psychological challenge than evil on a smaller scale?
Massive evil says something about something large about humanity. The Holocaust was perpetrated by a culture that was very developed intellectually, scientifically, in literature. It was perhaps the leading cultural country in the world at the time. And it tells us that there are two levels to the human psyche of the human soul. One is the level, which we might say is an above level, which we recognize. And there is beneath that another level, a dark level, which is sometimes subsumed by the former, repressed by the former, but we now know to what extent it is there and latent and built in to the human psyche. There have been, since the Second World War and since the Holocaust, there have been experiments in which this has come out. The famous experiments in which people were told to impose electric shocks on subjects, and they were able to impose electric shocks of great amounts to people because they were told to do so, or that was part of the experiment. And this was far beyond what would be considered to be proper behavior. So what happens now is that since the Second World War, we are in a position of dealing with human evil on a mass scale. It's no longer a matter of this country or this person or that person. That's what gave rise to the United Nations. Whether the United Nations is solving the problem or helping the problem is a matter of dispute. That's what gives rise to so many of the post-war, post-Second World War movements and attempts. It could lead to a great pessimism and to a great sadness, which is something I think which we're also seeing in the world's scale. That's how I see it.
You mentioned religious approaches and where the idea of evil is the challenge to overcome the inclination to evil, which is the self-interest, egoistic, natural character of human beings, and actually other animals too. What is the free will defense that argues that the existence of God is logically compatible with evil in the world? And also, give us some idea of how mystical religious thought views evil.
Well, as far as the free will defense, there are that name covers a number of different philosophical positions. Classically, the free will defense was that God was not responsible for moral evil, that is, the evil which human beings perpetrate, because it's human beings who are given free will by God, and our having free will itself is of value, something of great value, because free will is necessary for the production of good. If we were merely robots, then whatever we did would have no moral significance. And once we have free will, then it's in our hands to do evil. But since we have free will, God will not intervene in that exercise of that free will. Now, there are various problems with that position. It might explain some of, it might explain or defend God from some evil, but there are various problems with that position, which might ask, well, then why can't God interfere with some horrendous evils, extreme evils, which might be more worse than the good which free will affords to the world? More recently, the free will defense is a more complex position. And here, we really can't go into it in great detail in the time that we have. I apologize for that. But the position here is more like, it could be that God could not have created any world in which nobody chose to do evil. That any world God could create would be such that some people would choose to do evil. And the reason for that might be because if God gave free will, God cannot then determine that the people who have free will should choose only good, because that would take away their free will. So the idea is to try to, in a very abstract way, to absolve God from the freedom of our will. I might add here that there is a position which wants to go beyond explaining moral evil in terms of free will to explain also natural evils in terms of free will. Earthquakes, tsunamis, forest fires, and the like, as due not to human free will, obviously, but to the free will of the devil or the devils, that they freely choose to bring about earthquakes or the like, and that their free will is the most valuable gift which justifies this. That is going a bit too far, I think.
Right. I mean, religions have different views of unity and duality, both on the earth and cosmically.
Yes, yes.
And what about mystical views of evil?
Okay.
Like the Sufi, or actually every religion has its mystical aspects.
Well, there are different views. Yeah. It depends what mysticism you're talking about. In Buddhist mysticism, for example, with which I'm familiar, the Buddhist positions, you don't do away with evil, but so to speak, but you learn to, as it were, neutralize evil in your own consciousness, so that a Zen master could say, it's indifferent to me whether you give me $1 million or whether you now kill me on the spot. It's an indifference. It's a cultivation of indifference to evil with the purpose of becoming calm, tranquil, and happy. In Jewish mysticism, if we take, for example, the Hasidic mysticism of the Chabad Hasidism, all of our existence is not an actual real reality. We are a form in which the divine reality appears as a worldly reality, so that the evil, which is part of our world, in the final analysis is not a, I would say, an ontologically basic element of existence. And that when we overcome this crust, as it might be, over the divine being, it will be resolved that there is no evil. There's a famous story about a Hasidic person, who Rabbi Zusha was his name. He was asked to explain how God allows evil. And Rabbi Zusha was a very poor man. He had only, they say, one shirt to his in his whole repertoire of clothing. And he said he really can't answer that question because he has never experienced any evil. This is far beyond the you and me, of course, and I wouldn't turn it down, you know, on its face, but it's not going to help people who have endured serious tragedies and sorrows, people who have lost a son, people who have lost a daughter, people who have lost a close one, for example.
Getting as far away from mysticism as we can and still staying in the religious realm, let's look at Paul Tillich's emphasis on courage. How does courage help a believer deal with evil?
Well, there is a courage which is not so acceptable from my religious point of view, but it also is acceptable. Not acceptable in the sense in which it puts all of the responsibility on our own actions, that we are the ones who have to act, courageously in the face of evil. That would be to remove God from the picture. But there is a courage which asks us to act forcefully and fully against evil and not to give up. This is part of much of religious thinking, except you have in old Christianity what was called quietism, which did not recognize this. The quietists thought that you don't do anything. What God wants will happen whether or not you act. Quietism was roundly rejected by the church. There were some Hasidic and Judaism views that were of a quietist nature, but they were also rejected. We are called upon to act forcibly against evil with reason and with understanding. So I think that the courage is part and parcel of also what it means to be human. We don't give up. We don't give up easily. When we do give up easily, it's seen as a kind of aberration on human behavior. That's about what I have to say on that.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com. bookstagram.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Okay, well, let's move away from religion for a moment and look at science and so-called reason. One of your chapters mentions the science of evil and the evil of science.
Yes.
And so talk about the rationalist attempts to explain evil and the evil perpetrated in the name of value-free science.
Well, scientists have made attempts to talk about the sources of evil. This is a large topic. As explaining them in scientific terms, you can talk about scarcity of goods. You could talk about psychological needs and the like. The evils of science have to do with what scientists have cooperated with. There's a difference here between the evil of science and the science of evil. Science of evil is a cooperative effort. The evil of science is more a matter of individuals or particular cultures. The euthanasia that was practiced by the Nazis, for example, or the scientific movements which were part of, let's say, a minority, such as reading different physical traits of a person as dooming that person to be evil and the like. Much of that, of course, has gone by. But scientific explanations of evil are, as you say, attempt to be neutral, to be value neutral. Just one second. I have a note on that in my notes. Can I ask
sure.
you for a second?
Sure.
This is an article which is written by Ted Peters, and his view is that the evil of science is mostly in technology, and not in science itself. That is, in the way in which science has given rise to technologies which can be used for evil. And this comes out in what some people would ascribe to the Hiroshima Nagasaki bombings, which is controversial. But we see it all the time now in technology. So the evil of science is really more the evil of technology. And Ted Peters wants to make this distinction between technology and evil in itself, so to speak.
That's interesting, because we can say all technology beginning with fire has the potential for evil. So, yes.
That's true.
That's certainly part of it.
That's our free will, yes.
Yeah, and that you mentioned Hiroshima and Nagasaki brings up the subject of war, another thing that's been with us from the very beginning. I think few people would disagree that war is evil, even if it is sometimes necessary. What are the philosophical and moral differences between war and terrorism?
Okay, that's good, because there are two articles in this volume. One by Primerance about terrorism, and he defines terrorism the following way, and then I'll get to war. First, the fact that terrorism becomes a topic in the last 70 years of philosophical discussion of evil because of the obvious proliferation of terrorism around the world. So here's how Primerance defines terrorism. Deliberate violence against innocent people, civilians, for the purpose of intimidation or coercion against other people. Now, here's the point. It's deliberate violence against innocent people or civilians. In a war, as defined as war, it's not deliberate violence against innocent civilians. insofar as it's war. People, innocent civilians, might be hurt or killed by war, but insofar as it's war, it would not be deliberate violence against them. Secondly, the main purpose of a war is not necessarily to coerce other people, but it would be to defeat the people against whom you are issuing the violence. And that's what I think is a good distinction between war and terrorism. Now, war is brought up in an article by Fiala in the volume on pacifism and evil. And here is, we have to talk about the Catholic doctrine of a just war. The Catholics have a doctrine of just war in which the war has to be justified on moral grounds. So the very idea that you have an idea of a just war means that you recognize that there are wars that are unjust. And the justification of the war has to be strong enough and great enough with sufficient restrictions in order to make it justified. And one of the main restrictions is the protection of civilians. So when you're waging war, the war might involve terrorism within it. That is, within the war, if one attacks civilians purposefully, deliberately, innocent civilians, and with a purpose of, say, coercing other civilians to surrender to your troops, who will then kill them, then that's terrorism within war. But a just war would not have any terrorism with it, even though it might involve people who are innocent being killed by a just warfare or warfare event. And here we might have arguments about, was this war act sufficiently conscious of the result for innocent people? That would be the difference. Now, as far as pacifism, which I also want to take a second to talk about, there are pros and cons. When I was a undergraduate of philosophy about 100 years ago or so, I had a teacher who told us that until the Second World War, he was an absolute pacifist. He would not participate in any war whatsoever. But when it came to the Second World War and the fight against Hitler and the Nazis, he enrolled. He enrolled in the army and fought in Europe against the Nazis. So there was in him a moment of break from his avowed pacifism, and he was very earnest pacifist, to the point where he thought that pacifism was morally evil. And one of the arguments against pacifism is the pacifist is going along with evil and allowing it to increase. Unless you act violently against evil, you are committed, all right? You are implicated in allowing this to go on. So one of the pacifist answer often is, yes, we have to combat the evil, but in pacifist ways. There are other ways to do it. And here I might mention Mahatma Gandhi, who advised the Jews in Europe to do civil disobedience against the Nazis, the way in which the Indians did civil disobedience against the British. For example, when they protested the British monopoly on the sugar factories, they went and one at a time, they walked up to the gates of the sugar factories and the British clobbered them on the head, okay, and knocked them out one after the other. So he was advising that for the Nazis.
Yeah, passive resistance. That would not have worked.
Which the Jews would have been mowed down in a moment they would have all been murdered and killed and been made the Nazis extremely angry, etc. and so on. So this idea that you could combat evil in other ways than violence is true in many cases, but it cannot justify pacifism as a whole.
Now, sometimes evil appears to be a result of intolerance. For example, a fanatic's refusal to grant the space for someone to think or act differently. Let's look at the role and limitations of tolerance. In a world of diversity, most of our listeners would consider religious pluralism to be a good thing, but there would be less agreement about moral relativism. So tell us, what's similar and what's different between pluralism and relativism?
Okay, that's a good question, because I am not a pluralist, which, if you define pluralism as every view is as good as every other view, except perhaps if a view is morally evil, then that would lead to moral relativism, I think, in a quite a direct way, although there are a lot of people who would argue with me. In the book, there's a chapter by Robert McKim on religious pluralism. He argues of the benefits of religious pluralism. There's benefits of variety, and that one religion can learn from another religion. So when I said I'm not a pluralist, I didn't mean that I'm not open to learning or to recognizing in religions other than mine. I am a follower of the Jewish religion, of great value in other religions. And this is kind of a semi-pluralism, but it can lead to moral relativism. We have in the book an article by, let me see, I have to remember. Yes, by Kellenberger, who argues, who analyzes, various positions on moral relativism. But what's very interesting here is that up to the Second World War, there was much more inclination of anthropologists to argue for moral relativism than after the war, in that it became almost a commonplace of anthropology that we cannot judge other cultures by our own moral standards, because cultures have their own internal moral standards, and we are to respect those moral standards. Who are we to say that their moral standards are any less valid than our moral standards? Now, if you think of it, that is really an incoherent position, because if I see somebody in another culture going to murder somebody else, I will not ask myself, what are the moral standards of that culture before I try to prevent that? I will impose my own moral standards as being absolutely correct and have to be applied. But the fact is, this wasn't so much known to me. Kellenberger shows that this has declined. This anthropological position has declined. And I think it's a question of asking, according to the Nazis, there were two kinds of things that had to be exterminated. And this I'm quoting from the Nazi ruler or commissioner for all of Poland under Nazi rule. There are two things that have to be exterminated, rats and Jews. Now, would you say that because that is an internal moral position within Nazi Germany, that this is to be respected? Obviously not. And so this whole idea of moral relativism has to come up at heads with the realities of moral relativism. Now, the issue here is quite complex, because, for example, the position of feminists with regard to female circumcision, so-called, in some cultures. The issue becomes, do we impose our moral our feminine moral values and that culture? Or do we say, well, in that culture, that is the norm, and therefore we have to respect it. And here is a really a difference of opinion within some feminist positions. This happened with regard to the position of Black women within Black society in the United States and in the West. The same sort of question.
You can look at European countries today who are passing laws outlawing circumcision, which is a problem both for Jews and Muslims, because they argue that it is child abuse to put a knife on the body of an infant or a child, not for health reasons. Similarly, cruelty to animals restricts both Jews and Muslims in Europe, different places, from slaughtering meat according to their traditional laws. So that's the other side. Even though we all agree that child abuse is a bad thing, practitioners of those religions believe it's very important to perform that fundamental religious act. How would philosophy look at that?
Well, philosophy is philosophers, and we all argue about that. In fact, a famous philosopher once said, there's only one thing true about philosophy, that whatever you say, it doesn't work. Nothing works. So I do that. I say what I have to say with some reticence. But look, first of all, someone has said, I think quite directly, that if we really thought that it was wrong to allow abuse, I mean, we shouldn't have any children. Because I know that the child that I have, even if completely healthy, will suffer in his or her life all kinds of evils and even abuses of one sort or another. So if I really thought that we are responsible to prevent all abuses, I think we would have to come to the conclusion that we should not have children. But at the same time, we can see that, yes, causing pain to the baby is an evil, but it can be outweighed by other things. And that is the position of Muslims and of Jews, of course. Besides which, the issue here has to do with religious values versus, you might say, human values. And this is a large, large issue, which is now being, thankfully, being fought out in a way which was never fought out before in human history. So we are in a stage of human development in which these issues are coming out explicitly and being faced honestly. And this, we are just in the middle of having to work out such issues as the one that you are raising now.
Another popular notion these days is subjectivism, speaking one's own truth as being definitive in some way because it's individualistic and it's true for you. How does the discipline of philosophy view that notion, that idea?
Well, that's interesting because in a new book that I just authored, it just came out last month, I have a chapter which includes that kind of thing. But look, one can see it as simply an extension of egoistic, self-centered desires. What it's saying really is that I want to do what I want to do, and nobody can stop me. If that's what it is, and often I think that's what it is, then we should decry it. We should reject it. On the other hand, there's something healthy about it, in that we are allowing people to be more free than perhaps otherwise. Allowing them to think for themselves is good, but it certainly cannot be a moral position. In philosophical understanding, the definition of a moral statement is that it is universalizable, which is to say that it doesn't apply only to a particular position, particular context, or particular person, but it's universalizable. If you think it's right for you to steal from somebody else, if that's to be a moral assertion rather than simply a particular inclination, then it must be universalizable. If you think it's okay for you to steal, if that okay is a moral one, then you are committed to saying it's okay for everybody to steal. And that would include thieves. Yeah, includes yeah. Right. That would include it's okay for people to steal from you.
Okay, that's an important distinction. Yeah. So there seem to be two different views of human nature that permeate many of the chapters. At least in my reading of it. One view says human beings are born good, basically good, and circumstances cause them to become or to act in an evil way. The other view is simply the opposite, that people are born bad, they're selfish, driven by base impulses, and they're socialized, hopefully, to be better. What do you think are the advantages and disadvantages of each position? And did immersion into the subject persuade you in some way?
You got me stumped. You finally have stumped me.
Yeah?
It's hard for me to say. Yeah, I can only tell you what goes on in my mind when I hear this question or I think about this. Look, we now know about DNA.
Okay.
And we know about genetic inclinations of human beings. And we know that they can be for the good and they can be for what we call evil. But that's on the one side of it. We also know of cultural input, which can be for the good or for the bad. And we know of how people are influenced by both of them. It's hard to say. Look, it's hard to say which of them really counts for the most, except that in the demand for self-transformation from being an egocentric person to being an other-centric person, to be a giving person, I find it to be so damn difficult that I become more and more inclined to say that there's something a genetic barrier to our self-improvement. And that is why, hold on to your seat. That is why in my new book, I opt for a series of self-reincarnations, not in this world, but in other worlds. A series of worlds in which we are reincarnated in accordance with our needs for self-transformation to the good. And there are different worlds that God has created. After all, why should God create only one world? God can create many worlds. And we've passed through worlds in different kinds of worlds which are suited to our needs for self-development. And we ultimately will transform into godlike creatures. That is, creatures who are loving and good and do not put our selfish needs before others. And I see that because of the great difficulty of self-transformation in this world. My God would not allow this to be the end of the journey. So I look forward to, all of us look forward to many such worlds. You don't have to stop the conversation now. We can get back to more acceptable positions.
No, actually, you segued us to exactly where we're going, because we have been talking quite a while, and I wanted you to have a chance to tell us about your new book, and if you like, the one even before that, that's still pretty recent. First of all, you referred to your newest book. What's the name? So listeners, if they want to go find it, will know.
The name of the book is Perfect Goodness and the God of the Jews. Now, this book, in a sense, came out of my editing the book we have been discussing here all along.
Okay, that's very good.
I had to face directly and fully the issue of what appeared to be evil things that occur in the Jewish Torah attributed to God, evil things attributed, which seem to be part of the Jewish heritage or the Jewish tradition, as well as the general problem of evil. Perfect goodness in the God of the Jews. Can the God of the Jews, as depicted in the Hebrew Bible, can the God of the Jews, who is the creator and sustainer of the world, can that God be considered to be perfectly good? So that book is dedicated to that question and to that issue. But mind you, I don't try to solve the problem in the book. That's beyond me. I leave that to supernatural beings. The purpose of the book is to help a believer to alleviate the problem somewhat and to allow their faith to be operative in a stronger way than otherwise. So that book deals with, in great detail, with the problematics of evil in the Jewish tradition, and also with the problem of evil per se. And as I said before, it's not a matter of evil intruding into our lives. It's a matter of evil being an integral part of life, of being human, and just of reality. The way we are born, we live, we die, we suffer, etc., and so on. So it's a issue not about why do bad things happen to good people, the name of a famous book, but why is the evil so integral, so blatantly obvious in the very structure of our reality. And that book tries to help to lighten the issue to the point where faith in God can have a stronger operative role in life. But a lot, in a great sense, that book came about as a result of my editing this book, which told me, well, because in this book also, by the way, and I should mention that, there's an important chapter which deals with religion and evil, in which is taken up the whole issue of religion as being a force for evil in the world, whether it's religion or just human beings using religion. My other book, previous to that, was a different topic that had to do with the Hebrew Bible and history. In a way, it's related to that. That is a book about the necessity to agree that the Hebrew Bible, the Torah, in particular, can no longer be thought to be historically accurate all the way through. And I think that the development of that understanding, of that consciousness, is something that has been revealed to us by God, which is the title of the book, This Was From God. One who picks it up may think, oh, he's arguing again for the Bible being divine, but that this was from God in that book is saying that this was from God. The scientific development, which shows that not all the historical claims in the Bible can be taken as such, this has been provided, this understanding is from God, and it's making us come to a different understanding of the nature of Judaism and the nature of the Torah. So these are large topics, which we might talk about at a different time. But,
Absolutely. And And I wish you success with the newest book and the one before that, and more power to you. It's hard enough to keep up with reading your work. It's amazing that you continue to have the strength and the interest and the dynamic to produce them. So more power to you.
Well, I want to thank you as well, because you show a fine understanding of the issues. Your questions were very good and made good sense. And I want to congratulate you for that, because often an interviewer shows that she really doesn't know what it's about. In this case, you prove that you are very, very much aware and understand very well the issues. And I thank you for this opportunity to talk about them.
And thank you for being on the show today. And thanks as well to Bela Pasikov, our researcher. Bye-bye, Yehuda. Take care.
Bye-bye.